Now, we need the last, we're going to deal with all of these many texts in the last section. Divine authority and holy war.
Right, yes.
Not suicide, the afterlife.
Yeah, that's going to be the, dessert. Suicide is the dessert.
Wonderful. Well, like a good suicide.
That's the end of the thing, yes.
Okay, some of these are from different lectures. There's a lot of overlap, so between the first two sets, but the suicide and martyrdom texts are particularly interesting. So but now we're beginning with divine authority and holy war, right?
Yeah.
Do you have that, everybody? I already got it too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you already know the drill on this part, which is essentially that, you know, there are militant texts in the Hebrew Bible. That's the first item. That's Exhibit A.
Yeah.
Militant texts in the Hebrew Bible. Go out and kill people. Now, I actually want to look at Micah on page 2, the Micah text. Now, I read this a little bit differently than some other people read this. So, let's read the Hebrew, because we probably have all read this many times. Right? We're all together. Yehar Beit Adonai Nachon Barosh Harim V'nisahu Migvaot V'naharu Alav Amim. It's beautiful. And it is, I don't know, Naharu Alav Amim is translated as the people shall gaze on it with joy, but it also, what?
Stream there.
Yeah, it means they're sort of streaming to it, right? So, I equate this with the kind of totalitarian ultimate religion that everyone is going to worship our God. I don't see this in the kind of liberal, everyone's going to come to the realization that there's one God.
Mm-hmm.
I actually see this as more of an ethnocentric view. Now, I may be wrong, but it's my reading. I think that's, and now I'll give you more evidence. V'alchu goyim rabim v'amru l'chu v'na'ale el har Adonai v'el beit Elohei Yaakov. It's not just ha Elohim, it's Elohei Yaakov. V'yorenu midrachav v'nelchav orchotav. I think this is particularist. It's the same.
What is the first stage of his life, and what is the second stage of his life?
Okay. I would still argue that this is. Why don't they just say? I mean, you can't make it non-specific. You could say only Elohim, but they don't.
No.
Written here is Adonai. Adonai is a very tribal god.
Yes.
Adonai is the name of the god of Israel. It's not the name of the god of the Moabites or the Ammonites. They have different names. Kemosh.
Right. Is there a way to say God in general?
Why don't you say Elohim?
In theory,
one could say that. It may be impossible, actually, in that context because of the cultural association.
Mm-hmm.
It may simply be that Adonai is understood as a universal God,
uh-huh.
Right? But when you say Elohei Yaakov,
right, clearly that.
Hey, I'm suspicious about it. Mm-hmm. Now, here's more evidence to this, to support. V'shafat ben amim rabim v'hochiach l'goyim atzumim. What does that mean? That's not shafat shofet. That means who wreaks judgment. This is not the shofet who is sitting in the Beit Din, who is trying
judgment,
who
adjudicates.
No, doesn't adjudicate between. He is the judge. He is the punisher. Look how it's parallel.
Shafat it amim rabim,
in that case. Okay, Shafat ben amim rabim.
Yeah.
But it also says, v'chochiach, l'goyim atzumim. Great nations are going to be chastised by God. And it's in parallel with that. V'shafat ben amim rabim v'hochiach l'goyim atzumim. It's an exact example, perfect example of biblical parallelism. So you've got, right, you have amim rabim paralleled with goyim atzumim. You have shafat paralleled with hochiach. So this is one of a God of judgment. He's going to be the God of judgment to these people, many, many peoples. And v'chitetu harbotam le'itim v'chanitotehem v'mazmerot. It doesn't say v'chitetu harvoteinu le'itim, everybody's. It's they, those that are being judged and being chastised, are not going to be able to rise up against us anymore. And lo yis'u goy el goy cherev v'lo yilmudu od milchama. That's more universal. That's more equal. No goy is going to raise up arms against another goy. V'yashvu ish tachat gafno v'tachat tehinato v'en macharid ki pi or ki fi Adonai Tzvaot diber. Anyway, who's Adonai Tzvaot? God of the armies. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, this is we're talking about, this is martial, this is militant. Now we in the West read this, I think, probably, my view is that this is not the intent. Now, the Isaiah...
What do you mean? What was not the intent?
This, our reading, our Western reading of everyone being love, happy, that's not the reading. I think that's our reading. Mm-hmm. But I think that the contextual reading is God is going to prove the truth of his power, and everybody else's gods are going to be destroyed, or their no gods will be destroyed. You know, I'm not taking a position on whether they believe that they were gods or no gods.
Yeah, but then the last sentence.
Now that is not in the Isaiah version. That's only in the Micah version. The same text occurs in Isaiah without hey. And what I think, I'm suggesting, and I haven't done research on this, but my initial reading is, my hunch is, this text was an addition to a later version.
It's Keshet, yes.
Yeah. It truly is universal. This one is really truly universal, but the earlier reading is not. Right? Anyway, that's my hunch. I wouldn't bet my life on that, but... So I put that in the war text. I put that in the peace text. I put that not in the war text, but I put that in the domination text. And now look at the Leviticus one. I will grant peace in the land. This is a very nice text. We say that, right? V'natati shalom ba'aretz u'shchavtem ve'ein macharid v'yishpati chayar ha'am min ha'aretz v'cherev lo ta'avor ba'aretzachem. That's lovely. But read the next line. You know what Bruria says to the Pushtakim, she says, Zeh l'seifa, reka. She says, you idiot, go to the end of the verse. Urdaftem et oyveichem, v'naflu nifneichem lecharev. Because it's going to be peace in the land, because you're going to beat the hell out of all those other guys. You're going to destroy them. So, right? I'm sorry if I'm popping all of your bubbles.
No, absolutely not. But I only think when I read it, in how you define what your enemies are. If it's somebody who attacks you, or just somebody who happens to live there peacefully ever after, and you just knock the hell out of him.
Yeah. Okay. Don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
That's a good question.
That's
your interpretation of this word enemies. How do you use?
He was unfriended to you once.
Yeah.
He whistled at your wife.
Yeah. So
I don't completely agree putting this one in with these.
Okay, I don't, my point is, my point in taking this is that we read our texts
our way
because we want them to be meaningful. Excuse me, to us in a modern cosmopolitan world and we live there, but if we lived in a different world, even today, in the 21st century, we lived in a different environment in which life was not so good, we would probably be looking at these texts with very different eyes. We would see them much more as affirming our anger and our rage against the enemy, whoever they might be. And other
isn't
people
that almost with any text you take, you read it with your eyes from that moment?
Yes, yes. I recognize that we are a sophisticated crowd of people here in this small group. I do the same thing with Christians, and I say, look at your texts. You read your texts, and you think that these are statements of, you know, these are epitomize the, you know, perfect love of Christianity, but it's really not so.
You can read it my way.
Right. Yeah. Right. the difference between... Yeah.
So what you're saying is that the settlers, all right, therefore, there's no way of dealing with the current situation.
No, because they're reading it odioter radicali. You see? Everybody has their own strategies. Everybody has their own eisegetical strategies in which they are inserting meaning into the text to give the authority for their emotions and their feelings and their political positions. But if we recognize that, you need to recognize that.
Yes, but if we live in the Middle East where the Muslims read Quran this way,
yeah, but Muslims don't read the Quran this way. Some Muslims read it this way, and some Muslims read it that way. So as soon as you say the Muslims do it this way, you're already screwing up because you're then because you're putting them into I know you're putting the words you use somebody else's words. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now in chapter 20 of Deuteronomy, these are good to review. Because here are two rules of engagement. You see how I have down these subcategories here? I have deferments. These are deferments from war, from verses
What's
5.
Deferment?
Means you don't have to go to war.
Because
yeah.
You don't have to if you have your wife waiting at home.
So let's read those, because let's do that. Someone want to read verses 5 and following? I don't care if it's in Hebrew or in English. Okay.
Then the officials shall address the troops as follows. Is there anyone who has built a new house but has not dedicated it? Let him go back to his home, lest he die in Bethel and another dedicate it. Is there anyone who has planted a vineyard but has never harvested it? Let him go back to his home, lest he die in Bethel and another harvest it. Is there anyone who has paid the bride price for a wife but has not yet married her? Let him go back to his home, lest he die in battle, and another marry her. The official shall go on addressing the troops and say, is there anyone afraid and disheartened? Let him go back, lest the courage of his comrades flag like his. When the officials have finished addressing the troops, army commanders shall assume command.
Okay, so the deferments are really to keep the wavering people out of the army. If you think someone's not going to be wholeheartedly interested in fighting and engaging in war and doing killing and all those things because they have other things on their mind, you don't want them there because they're going to cause trouble for your own side. So okay, this is a military decision. This is not because you have Rachmanis on the person. Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think
the thing about the house is that, is it a euphemism or is it really about the house?
I think it's not a euphemism. I think if they didn't have the bride part, it might be a euphemism. Yeah, I think it's really that I just built this house. I want to get my butt back home. I don't want to go out there. And I, you know, what about those? All those good grapes are going to be rotting on the vine. What am I here for? Right. And so they're not going to fight. Be good fighters. And the last line I think explains why. You know, if there's anyone's afraid. Because we don't want his comrades to become afraid like him. So then you have two rules of engagement. Rules of engagement, you know, there's our military rules of engagement. So the first one is, may I have a reader for that?
When you approach a town to attack it, you shall offer it terms of peace. If it responds peaceably and lets you in, all the people present there shall serve you at forced labor. If it doesn't surrender to you, but you join battle with you, you shall lay siege to it. And when Adonai, your God, delivers it into your hand, you shall put all its males to the sword. You may, however, take as your booty the women, the children, the livestock, and everything in the town, all its spoil and enjoying the spoil of your enemy, which Adonai your God gives you. And thus you shall deal with all towns that lie very far from you, towns that do not belong to nearby nations. Wow, the heroes.
So this is the rules of engagement that Muhammad employed with the Jews of Medina. See, if they would have given up and wouldn't have attacked him, then they would have to join him.
This is to Netanyahu yesterday. We are prepared to give up a lot of things for the Palestinians, make peace with them on our terms.
Great. It's like kicking himself. I mean, he's putting his foot in his mouth when he does it. But,
And it's not if Adonai you go to them.
Yeah.
You have to do it.
And when, yeah. And by the way, when you offer it, you shall offer it terms of peace. You know what that means? V'karata elaha l'shalom. It means, really means to submit. You're saying, will you submit to our rule?
Yes, okay.
It's or not.
Yeah, we won't kill you. Just for
it's not. It's not. But in the English, in the English, it doesn't sound like that. In the karate, you
well,
shall offer.
Well, in response peacefully, unless you all the people present there shall serve you with forced labor.
Yeah, that's not what we're called terms of peace.
No, surrender.
Yes, that's absolute surrender. Okay, this is the good rules of engagement. Now let's go. Now notice this. Notice number 14. You may, however, take as your you kill them all, those men.
The men, yeah.
And then you may, however, almost as if this is exceptional, take as your booty the women, the children, the livestock, and everything in the town, all its spoil, and enjoy the spoil of your enemy.
Yeah,
which Adonai your God gives you.
Yes, but you see, this is different from instruction in other places, because there you actually have
Don't go there. Now let's go to rules. And now rules of engagement number two. Okay, so.
In the towns of the latter peoples, however, which Adonai your God is giving you as a heritage, you shall not let the soul remain alive.
Ah, right.
No, you must utterly destroy them. The Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as Adonai your God has commanded you, lest they lead you into doing all the abhorrent things that they have done for their gods, and you stand guilty before Adonai, your loving God.
I don't think that one was there. So, all right.
Do I have any sort of idea what the abhorrent things are really? Because we always say this, the idols and all that sort of stuff.
No, but they do give a few more details sometimes. And sometimes they talk about male prostitution, fertility acts. It seems to be, do you want to get everybody... I'm going to use very crude terminology in English. You want to get the gods horny, get them sexually excited, so that they can spew their sperm all over the world and get everybody pregnant. You want the sheep to get pregnant, the women to be pregnant, the crops to be pregnant.
The sheep and the women, that's okay.
Yeah, in that order. So, and the gods do this by getting all excited. And how do you get them excited? You have sex. So you have public sex acts, and anybody who watches public sex acts gets excited. That's the theory, right?
So why were we so against that?
It was actually a lot of fun, I'm sure.
So, I mean, really, it's a serious question. So where is this incredible no comes from?
Prudery.
Yeah, it's very, that's a good question.
What?
Typically Jewish.
No, I mean, it's like...
No, well, it is. I wouldn't say it's one of the tenets of Judaism.
It is, but how did it get to be this tenet of Judaism? I mean,
no, it has to do with idolatry and fertility rights and.
Yeah, but I mean, idolatry is already branding it from before you look at it. You know, it's like. When you look at it, okay, this is what's happening. What was so negative? Okay, maybe it doesn't belong here.
It's just that the idea that one of theism is civilized, and these cultural, these fertility rights are
not civilized.
Anything but civilized.
Well,
yeah.
This is someone else's civilization.
Of course, but from our point of view.
Okay. No, but it still doesn't answer the question.
No, but you have a lot of the structuring society. There's a lot where taming the beast in
yeah, but
in
taming the beast is already from the perspective that you have that it is taming the beast.
No, it isn't. No.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying now.
Okay, but
the people then culturally apparently found it necessary to institute a number of things. You know, I think you would need to have an anthropologist explaining a number.
I think it's such an overpowering power. It really, a lot of life is focused just on the whole sexual thing.
Still is.
It's always been. So it probably want to get hold of that aspect of the brain, which is influencing behavior.
If you look at halakha, let's not
go over there because it's just not.
Hang on. If you look at the whole halakhic structure, there are three areas.
I understand that, but this is already past the point.
Right.
That's not discussing because
there are ecstatic forms of religion, like tantric yoga, things like that, which actually use sex as a way of getting to a unity with God or to reach, right? There's nothing. I mean, Judaism has all kinds of other kinds of ways of reaching God, but that's somehow that one never took off in Judaism. But even in Kabbalah, is there any kind of Kabbalistic approach that uses sex as a way of reaching God?
It's more cerebral.
Yeah.
And also the Christian tradition where you're married, you marry God, and your vows are to God rather than to sexual partner. Yeah, but I mean, I think it all boils down to the fact that it's a fact. I think that humans got screwed up somewhere along the evolutionary process. And men and women are attracted for sex not only, 30 days during the year, but, 7 days, 365 days during the year. And that causes a lot of havoc, because nobody's going to go out and plant and do things that need to be done if we keep having sex all the time. And if, so we can't do our survival job, and so we kind of socialize in a million different ways to restrict that constant drive, and that is so we have fantasies, I think, of having it not restricted, and the fantasies are usually applied to other people because they're not civilized.
Right.
So minorities, anytime you have a minority community, usually the majority community thinks the minority community are hypersexual, and all that stuff, and that's all part of the fantasy that we sort of wish that we could like readjust our culture, but at some level we know. Really do it because otherwise nobody will go to work. The rabbis had it; they knew about the Yetzer. Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing, but it's a problem. The Yetzer Hara, the Yetzer Ha, whatever, Hakef, maybe, or something, right? Something. You didn't like that one. You don't just don't say B'shem Omro.
But if they were Canaanites. You take them out and you say, you're now different, you shouldn't be Canaanites anymore, then you have to leave all the things Canaanites do, just because Canaanites do them, we don't do them.
But you do take the wives, the women.
Yeah.
Yeah, but only for people far away. A Thai woman is okay. but not the neighbor's wife.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, so now let's go and see how wonderful Christianity is.
The likelihood of her husband coming after you. Yes, especially for the Torah phrase.
So I'd like to have someone read the Matthew chapter 5 verse.
You have heard that they were told, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But what I tell you is this. Do not resist those who wrong you. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn and offer him the other also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your cloak as well. If someone in authority presses you into service for 1 mile, go with him too.
This was the macho rhetoric, the terrorist rhetoric.
But I heard a very interesting interpretation of this, and that is that this is guerrilla theater.
Did you tell us.
They said, "Yeah, give him, hit me again." Excuse me. Right? Yeah. You want my shirt? Here, take my cloak. Yeah, everybody, look. I'm giving. Here's this jerk. Ask for my shirt. Here, have my cloak. You need to press me in service for a mile? I'll go for 2 miles. To kind of ridicule the nastiness and the unpleasantness. But I don't know if that's true. So, just in case it isn't true, let's look at Matthew 10. Someone want to read that?
Yeah. You must not think that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I've not come to bring peace, but the sword.
This is Jesus speaking.
Yeah. I've come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man will find his enemies under his own roof. Oh, is the paranoid. No one is worthy of me who cares more for father or mother than for me. No one is worthy of me who cares more for son or daughter. No one is worthy of me who does not take up his cross and follow me. Whoever gains his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will gain it.
Schnitzel.
No, it's Führer. It's Führer. No, Schnitzel wouldn't do that. That's not Schnitzel
wouldn't say
if
it's a situation.
No.
So here, okay, now it doesn't say go out and kill somebody. But it's a rageful, violent rhetoric. It's not love and sweet grace. And I think I said it earlier, right? In the context of the emergence of Christianity, engaging, acting out on the angry emotions that everybody has, rageful emotions, resentful emotions, would have been suicidal. So the New Testament hides the natural rage and anger that's directed against the establishment or articulates it in ways that are safe, that are not self-destructive. If you said go out and and kill those Romans or kill those Jews, you would be destroyed yourself because the Jews and Romans had a lot more power than the early Christians did. So it can't say that. And presumably there's a little bit of evidence out there that there were some religious movements that did say go out and kill those Romans and kill the people who are oppressing us, and they were destroyed without a trace, basically only a few remnants left. So Christianity is also no less, I would say, there's no measurement to measure, you have a number of, 62 of violence in your tradition, you have 64 in your tradition, 64 what? There's no measurement for this. But I would simply say, in general, this explains why Christianity sees itself or considers itself less militant, only for these reasons. Okay, so we don't have to. You're familiar with the Matthew verse about the hypocrites, the Pharisees, very angry rhetoric against the Pharisees. Acts 10, I don't know why it's there. Luke, also, this is a repetition of the Matthew verse. I have come to set fire to the earth, how I wish it were already kindled. Also a kind of angry, violent kind of rhetoric. It's a different take on the same moment in Jesus' life. And you know about John, who calls the Jews children of the devil. That's also a reaction probably to the Jews ridiculing Jesus and trying to discredit him. There's a lot of anger and rage directed back against them.
Peter Thomson's book, It's Not in Heaven. Only if this is from heaven, is dealing specifically with New Testament anti-Semitism, and John in particular.
As if it isn't heaven?
Yeah, I keep it
If this is from heaven, I think it's called.
Ik heb het thuis, het was voor mij alleen.
Meneer Fox.
Ja,
dat is een film. Ja, dat is een Swedish one. Het zijn
Okay, so we've just did short shrift with the New Testament. Now let's look at the Mishnah just briefly. This is some of the evidence that I use in my book, which I know everyone will buy and read in, with great interest, on Jewish Holy War that's coming out next year. Don't worry about it. It's not. I'll tell you everything you need to know about it here. The Mishnah, the rabbis did something. The rabbis were confronted with a problem. The problem was that Judaism is a very militant tradition in the Bible. It's a military religion. You have troops, and you have a violent God. God is called Ish Milchama, Adonai Tzvaot, and there are a lot of military battles. There's a kind of a mathematical formula. I think that the Bible is producing, and the formula is: obey God, you win, you beat your enemies. Disobey God, your enemies will beat you. And it's a pretty consistent formula. And then it starts to break down. It works through the Maccabees, and then that formula no longer works anymore against the Romans. You can obey God and do all the things right, according, you know, and then you go against the Romans and you lose bad. So the rabbi said, of course, no, that's not a breakdown in the formula. It's just you thought you were obeying God, but you weren't obeying God. So sort of search your souls and figure out what you did wrong, and life will get better. So they did. They searched their souls. They got better. They did basically Mishnaic Judaism. They went against the Romans again, and they still got destroyed. So that formula, it had to be preserved one way or another. A new modus operandi had to be developed by the rabbis, and they did it through the development of two instruments that were invented by the rabbis to resolve the problem and to try to make Judaism a non-militant religion. And one of them I refer to here very, very briefly, and that is dividing all of the wars of the Bible into two categories: Mechemet Mitzvah and Mechemet Reshut. Right? So in Mishnah Sota, the chapter 8, Perek Shmone of Sota, deals with all the deferments that were listed in Deuteronomy 20. And all the Mishnayot there deal with the deferments. And then at the very end, the last statement of that of the Mishnah is V'ma devarim amurim v'mechemet harashut ava v'mechemet mitzvah hakol yotz'in afilu chatan michadro v'chala michuchatan. So what are all these deferments referring to? They're referring to a category called Milchemet Reshut, discretionary war, but not Milchemet Mitzvah, divinely commanded war. There are no deferments. Everybody goes, including even if the man and a woman under a wedding canopy, everybody goes to war. So the Mishnah very brilliantly understands that the Bible has divided its many, many different versions of wars and battles and skirmishes into two categories. One is called Mechemet Reshut, one is called Mechemet Mitzvah. In fact, the Bible is not divided into categories at all. This is all imposed on the Bible, but it's imposed for a purpose, I think. And the purpose was to kind of deal with it, with the problem, and then stop dealing with it. Don't talk about it, don't treat it, don't keep discussing wars, because wars are too dangerous.
Which I keep pointing out in the Hanukkah story, that you have the Haftarah chosen, not with power, not with might, it's not by word, the little light that flames, but push away the Maccabean, and do the peaceful thing. You pray and wait for the Mitzvah.
Exactly. It's all supported. If you read the version of Hanukkah that's found in Maccabees, it's very militant. If you read the version of Hanukkah found in Josephus, it's very militant. But those two categories are not in our canonical literature.
Exactly.
In the canonical literature, you have one little paragraph in the Talmud. It doesn't even get into the Mishnah. It's in the Talmud. And Baraita is in the Talmud.
Nice Talmud.
So, yeah.
There is one other, which talks about a donkey going through the shuk. And it don't put your Chanukiah in such a way.
It has a fire or something like that. So, all right, so then, but it doesn't give, in the Mishnah, it doesn't say what's a Milchemet Rishut and what's a Milchemet Mitzvah. So, that gets developed in the Gemara, both in the Babylonian Gemara and in the Palestinian Gemara. And it says, you know, so Milchemot Yoshua Lichbosh is Divrei HaKol. These are, it's more complicated. It gets complicated because there's two different words that are used for what seems to be obligatory war. One is chova and one is mitzvah. And that's because there seem to be two different traditions. And the rabbis spend a lot of time trying to figure out what's the difference or is there a difference. But to make a long story short, the rabbis basically define milchemet mitzvah or chova, however you call it, for which there are no deferments, is Milchamot Yoshua Lichbosh. So that's Milchemet Mitzvah. So all the other wars are, their deferments apply, which means that these are not absolutely commanded wars, but the conquest of Yoshua is a commanded war. So what does that mean? There were two ways to interpret that. One could say, it was only the wars of Joshua that were commanded wars. There can be no more other wars in history that are commanded wars, because it says specifically, Milchamot Yoshua. Right? Another way to interpret that verse is, Milchamot Yoshua are the kinds of wars that you can say that there's no deferments for, and those are Milchamot Mitzvah. And so therefore, today in the West Bank, making sure that we control the land that was conquered by Yoshua is acceptable. That is Mechamet Mitzvah, and it's commanded today, etc., etc. But that's a bit of a stretch, but there's been a lot of work in the last, 30 years to try to make that happen. This isn't so important for us right now, but there is another instrument that the rabbis created to try to prevent war from occurring, and that's known as the three vows. And I don't have them in here. But there are three vows that the rabbis talk about. It's called Shalosh Shavuot.
You don't go to war. You go to war.
Right. And they're derived from Shir HaShirim. And in those, from a statement, it says, I don't remember what it is. But there's a statement that's repeated three times in Shir HaShirim about, don't go until the time is right, or something like that. Benot Yerushalayim, Al Ta'alu, or something like that. Ad Shetechpatz, or until it's desired. And that is understood by the rabbis in a very kind of, not very direct exegetical, not a pshat for sure, to mean that there are three times that God says to the Israelites, you have to take a vow. There are three vows that God makes people vow. Two of them are directed to Israel, and one is directed to Ummat HaOlam. The two vows directed to Israel are, you shall not rebel against the Goyim, and you shall not go up as a wall. It's understood to be making aliyah or immigrating.
What's the second one? You shall not
rebel against the Gentiles.
Yeah.
And the second one is you shall not go up as a wall. And that's understood. You should not make any mass immigration to the land of Israel, because that's going to be inciting the people that live there to get angry at you and to fight you. And in recompense or whatever, and reward for that, God makes the Ummat HaOlam promise not to persecute the Jews too much.
It's third vow.
Yeah. You'll tear me down. That's the term that's used. So the Ummat HaOlam can persecute the Jews, but it's not you'll tear me down.
This is where the definition of anti-Semitism comes from.
Well, that's where the Zionists got away from, right? From the
The Zionists weren't working. Yeah, they got away from it because they weren't religious.
Well, the rabbis put this in against Zionism.
Yes.
And whoever wanted to defend it said, get rid of that.
The secular Zionists said, we don't worry about God, we don't worry about Mohammed Mitzvah, that's not... But the religious Zionists had a problem with that. And they had to deal with that.
Right.
But if you say, the rabbis gave three vows...
No, there were already three vows.
There were three vows, which God gave to whom?
To Israel, and one
to
Goyim.
One to Goyim, okay. Then.
Yeah. God made Israel vow twice, and Goyim...
And one of the criticisms of the Zionist movement in the early period, especially by the Hasidim, because they were really anti-Zionism, was that you're going against the Gentiles by forming a movement, and you're going against the Gentiles by making Aliyah. You're going up as a wall. But when at the agreement at San Remo, and the Balfour Declaration was cited by some Orthodox Jews to say, well, now we're not, because here we have the ruling power is saying that the Jews can come to the land of Israel, so you're not rebelling against any of the Gentiles, because the ruling power is inviting the Jews, and so that's not doing that. And we're not going up as a wall because we've been invited in by the host country. And then the League of Nations. Yeah, so, you know, there's moving back and forth. Yeah, right. But those instruments or those issues have been have been dealt with quite a bit in the Orthodox Zionist community. And after 1967, the one phrase from Shir Hashirim Ad Shetechpat, until it is desired, was interpreted by some to say, well, after 67, this is proof that the Messiah is on his way, God really wants us to be involved, so now it's desired, so now we should go up as a wall, and we should rebel against the Gentiles. It's not really rebelling against the Gentiles, it's really claiming what is truly ours, and so it's a kind of revival of the paradigm. But... Anyway, that's a short synopsis. If you don't want to talk about this, we can go right to the Quran. Shall we go to the Quran? Okay. So the first two, I think we already looked at.
Yeah.
Right? Let's go to the box on the bottom, page 6. May I have a reader for that?
Permission is given to those who fight because they have been wronged. God is most powerful for their aid. Those who have been unjustly expelled from their homes only because they say our Lord is God. If God had not warded off some people by means of others, then monasteries and churches and synagogues and mosques in which the name of God is often cited would have been destroyed. God most certainly helps those who help him. God is strong and mighty.
It's actually kind of an interesting verse, isn't it?
Very.
Yeah. But it's not only helping themselves, it's helping others. It's one of this sort of believer's verse, right? You need to support monasteries and churches and synagogues and mosques. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So.
It talks about those who have been thrown out of their houses. There will be Muslims, new followers.
Yes.
Who have been persecuted because they were followers.
Right.
And that refers back to Mecca, or
probably, if it refers to anything, it must refer to the exile from Mecca of the earliest Muslim community by the Meccan pagans. That's the assumption. Now, I'm sorry, for some reason, the print, the font in the English didn't do what I wanted it to do, so I didn't have to fix this. But so the word in Quran 7:3 and 66:9, those are parallel. There's the same, it's the same verse that's repeated in those two locations. And it says, strive, it's, the word is jihad, so it's jihad is in the command form. Make jihad against the unbelievers and the dissenters, and be ruthless with them. Their refuge is hell, a bad destination. In case you weren't clear about that.
Must be filling, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is all, this is used now for people who change their minds about Islam. They use it.
Well, the word is munafik. Munafik is usually translated as hypocrites. And that
instead of unbelievers?
Or no, unbelievers is kuffar.
Okay. So this
now remember that unbeliever can refer to Jews or polytheists.
Dissenters.
Dissenters.
Yeah, dissenters. Yes, yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah, dissenters. But I translated dissenters because I don't think hypocrites is such a
Protestant term.
It may be, and I'm not familiar with that as a Protestant term, but it becomes such, it fits a paradigm of Islamic self aggrandizement. It means, I think what it really was referring to were people who converted to Islam because they thought they were getting something that they ended up not getting, so they weren't very supportive.
No, I understand that, but nowadays this text being used as, you know, we can harm the people who turn away from Muslims, who turn away.
Yeah, who become non-Muslims.
Become non-Muslims.
Yeah, I don't know, frankly, I don't know if it's this text that has been used for that, but some kind of proof text has been used. You probably could, but maybe not, I don't know. I just can't say that it was. So, so, you want to do the next one? Someone?
Oh, you who believe, fight the unbelievers who are near to you and let them find ruthlessness in you and know that God is with the pious.
Pious here means Yirei Shamayim. It's probably, that's probably Yirei Shamayim.
Yirat Shamayim.
So the pious people are Yirei Shamayim. So it's not pious in the Christian sense. Pious in the Christian sense you think of as being kind of a monk, a monas, who's, you know, vegetarian, quiet. It doesn't mean that. You could be a, you know, Yirat Shamayim could be going out to battle in the Jewish context. Now, the next one, Quran 9:5, is, I can assure you that this is a proof text that's used to battle polytheists and kill them. And this has been cited by many Muslims throughout history as the quintessential militant verse. It's sometimes called the sword verse. Ayat al-Saif. So, let's have a reading for that.
When the sacred months have passed, kill the idolaters wherever you find them, and seize them, beset them, lie in ambush for them everywhere. If they repent and establish the prayers and pay the zakat, then set them free. God is forgiving, compassionate.
Okay. Yeah. That's pretty heavy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's not exactly what you think it is. It says kill them, but if they repent, make tshuva. The word is. This Taub, right? And they do that by establishing prayers and pay the zakat. Then don't kill them; you set them free.
But still, it's, you know, when they say kill the idolaters wherever you find them, so you have to go and look for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just, you know, let them live their lives. If they're happy that way, why can't you let them be?
Right, because polytheism is by definition evil.
If they don't harm anybody with it, they live their lives and we live our lives.
You're a 21st century person.
You also have to keep in mind that it was the polytheists that were the real, the idolaters were really the enemy to Muhammad, more than the Jews. They were the ones who were going to destroy him. They forced him out of town. They killed his followers when he was weak. But he really, really did not like
him. I keep forgetting to play the text in those days.
Yes, he was fine.
You better remember, he destroyed their business.
But that doesn't mean that people are not reading it today. Not in that context. They're reading it today as idolaters, wherever you are, we should go up and kill you. There are people who do that.
Yeah.
And but also notice, does it say they should convert to Islam in order to be saved?
No.
No. It doesn't, does it? It says be a believer.
Be a believer.
But don't be a Muslim. It's not be a Muslim, be a believer. So that means that you could be a Jew, you could be a Christian, be a monotheist.
The sense I keep getting from all these texts, and it was also when I read your book, that all these monotheistic religions seem to be so incredibly paranoid and projecting and sick. I mean, yeah,
they have the truth.
Yeah, it is a kind of thing.
It really felt like get away from all of that, you know? It's like projecting all the time, not really dealing with what people are really probably doing. Anyway.
Yeah, it's a problem.
But
we're
I'm
stuck.
Right, you're wrong.
We're stuck with it. What?
I'm right, you're wrong.
I personally feel, and I don't want to go into this long tangent, but I personally feel that that's a structural problem in the notion of monotheism. I mentioned this to you before. There's one God, one message. Anybody who does it differently is threatening to us. If we were polytheists, who would care? Another God, another message. It's no big deal. But not.
It seems like it comes out from a sort of mental illness.
Almost, doesn't it?
And the fact that it also leads to being obsessive and you know, so has all the extremism all built into it.
So could someone open up Quran chapter 9, verse 5, and read it in Dutch, and then read verse 6 that comes after that?
9?
Yeah, 9, verse 5, and then continue to 9, verse 6.
En wanneer iemand onder de afgodsdienaren jouw bescherm zoekt, bescherm hem tot hij het woord van Allah hoort, en breng hem dan naar zijn veilige plek. Dit omdat zij een volk zijn dat niet weet.
Als de heilige manen zijn verspreken, dood dan de vele goden dienaars waar jullie hem vinden. Grijpt hem, belegert hem en wacht hem op in elke mogelijke hinderlaag. Maar als het berouw tonen, de salaat verrichten en de zakat geven, leg hem daar niets in de weg. God is vergevend en barmhartig.
En
als een van de veergoden dienaars jouw bescherming zoekt, geef hem dat bescherming totdat hij het woord van God hoort en laat daarna een plaats bereiken waar hij veilig is. Dat is omdat zij mensen zijn die niet weten.
So, now how does this next following verse relate to this verse?
They don't know. They just don't know.
This is the Jew who doesn't know anything and counts him as a child that was kidnapped and he was brought up without knowing he was Jewish. Therefore, he doesn't follow the mitzvot, but he doesn't know any better. So this is someone who doesn't know any better.
Yeah, but so if you're supposed to go kill them all, then the next verse you invite them in and you say, just throw a little bit, figure it out. So they seem to be in absolute total contradiction, one from the other.
Except that if he doesn't want to come in, then you can.
So
no, but first is the teshuva. He has already done teshuva, isn't it?
Not necessarily. No.
That's like the verse we read before, you know, if they kill them, unless you tell, you know, they don't reject, and they have to submit to you. The first part.
Are you sure that's really what it's saying? I mean, I don't have the English in front of me or the Dutch in front of me, so I don't know.
It's the verse before.
Okay.
Verse 4 says, proclaim a woeful punishment to the unbelievers, except to those idolaters who have honored their treaties with you in every detail and aid it not against you. So, if someone is coming to you to seek asylum, that means they trust you. They trust that you're not going to kill them. And so there's a sense of, if they're willing to trust you, then that there's some opening for discussion. You have an opening there.
Okay. So what are the sacred months, then? According to the Muslim commentators, and it's not clear whether they get it or not, I don't know if this is the contextual meaning, but the sacred months was a period of time in which Muhammad said, all of you that have these treaties, right, you must honor the treaties for 4 months, and when those 4 months are passed, you have no responsibility anymore to idolaters. Announce to the idolaters that you're going to remain in treaty with them. If they owe you money, they're probably not going to pay you back after the 4 months. But if you owe them money, pay them, because you have to be responsible for your relationships. But when these 4 months are over, it's all over. Now it's total war against the idolaters. So that would then sort of explain the previous verse, right?
Okay.
So that means you kill all the idolaters unless they give zakat and establish prayers and all that. Then the next verse says, invite the idolaters in. Presumably, if they paid the zakat and established prayers, they're no longer idolaters, right? So this seems to be a contra verse.
No, he doesn't say invite them in. When somebody knocks on your door and please help me, then you should talk to him.
May I see the Arabic on this one?
The Arabic?
Isn't there a cultural...
I thought that was the sacred month, where it was the period where you could not fight because they had to do business and marriage and all that sort of stuff.
I'm sorry, you missed what you said?
I thought the sacred months originally were the months in the tribal communities where nobody fought each other because otherwise no business was possible,
right.
and everybody was doing their marriages,
right.
And all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And when it stopped, then it was all out war,
right.
Or
right.
If you wanted to do it.
Right.
But everybody had to respect these months.
Right. It could be, because those are also called sacred months, but... What I remember from the interpretive tradition is that this is referring to a special time. This whole chapter 9 is a chapter that is sort of like resetting the standards after you have to end your relationships with all polytheists. So you may be right. I mean, I think that would fit too.
That's what I heard.
But that would fit in theory. One could make the case that we're talking about the old sacred months, and once those sacred months have passed this year, then that old system is no longer functional. It's now all out war. So either one means that after a certain period of time in which you have treaties and arrangements, it's all over. And you're right. It is what I mean. That your translation does say what the Arabic says, when Ahadid Minum Shrikun, Istajaraka, they ask for your gar with you. Yeah. Then you should bring them in so they hear the words of God and that sort of thing. So I read this as almost as a counter view of the previous one. Because why should you open up your home and your settlements to polytheists if you're supposed to go out and kill them?
If the first one is a projection, then there must be some people who say, okay, hang on a second, let's see who these people really are, and let them bring in because they don't know. Everybody is crazy.
There is a tradition of asylum, but what they're asking for is not to hear the word of God. They're asking for
protection.
They were asking for protection.
Right, but if you consider your hospitality sacred,
mm-hmm.
right, and someone comes in, that means that they have faith in your asylum, that you'll honor your obligation and protect them. So I think that means there's some opening for discussion, at least, that there's some trust in the system, in who you are, and then you can have the conversation.
It's already in halfway first 5, that when they show remorse, and they keep prayer, and they pay the tzedakah, then you can let them free.
Mm-hmm.
So these are probably also the people who would knock on your door, because the other one, you know, they're killed already, or
you're anathema.
Now
you
can also be saying, "I don't show."
Well, in this, yeah. Well,
your throat.
Okay, all right. So maybe, so it's not such age. So you don't think it's a counterverse?
Because if it's, I mean, if all the idolaters knew that the Muslims were out to kill them, right? And you walked into someone's home, you'd be dead. So there has to be some sense that if you went into their home, they wouldn't kill you. So they, you
said
there's some faith that something was different.
Okay, so that may be right. That may be right. Did you, by the way, you said when they paid the zakat or if they paid the zakat?
But when they show remorse and pray and pay the sadaqah, let that, this is a translation here.
Okay, so in Arabic it says if they show remorse and they.
If
yeah.
When.
Yeah.
But if it's the same thing.
Yeah. He was just if.
Yeah.
It's if. It's ask and all the day
but in this case, you know, if they show remorse, you let them in. So it's not.
Is this sort of a base for the dhimmi status? Because it says you protect them. They're unbelievers. They don't know what they're talking about.
They're not unbelievers.
They're idolaters. No, we're gonna the next box is the dhimmi status.
Yeah, but I wonder if this sort of a transition from polytheists to.
You can't. Well, later on, maybe in this, in the Quran, it might be different. But at least later on in Islamic tradition and law, you can't transition from a polytheist to a Jew or Christian. You can only transition from a polytheist to a Muslim. That's not acceptable. If you're going to become a monotheist, you should become the best monotheist. If you're already a monotheist, that's a different story.
Okay. We know this is interesting. That's interesting.
Why?
Because they want to go for the monotheism.
Who?
Oh, they would prefer to, okay, you know, you would prefer the Muslim, okay, because you know we're the last and the best.
Yeah.
But go from poly to mono, it would be okay, but it's not okay.
It's not okay.
I think that's interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
Stereo is better than mono.
Eh?
Stereo is better than mono.
For some.
So let's go to Quran 9:29. Yeah, 9:29.
Fight those who do not believe in God or in the last day, who do not forbid what God and His messengers forbade, and who do not practice the religion of truth among those who have been given the book, until they pay the
jizya
of hand, being humbled and humiliated.
Humbled or humiliated, depending on how you read that word. Right?
So, jizya.
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 Jizya is the Arabic. And jizya is the commentators don't know what jizya means, and they don't know what anyadin means. And they're not clear what wahum sagirun means. That's the meaning, right? We know that sagir is like za'ir. Small in Hebrew Aramaic, so it means something that they're in a reduced status of some sort. The question is whether it's slightly reduced or really radically reduced. The jizya was understood to be some kind of a tax, and it ended up becoming canonized as a poll tax. Anyadin means from hand or by hand or something like that, and that was not clear what that meant. But it came to be established in law that Jews and Christians should be fought. But the word is fight, not kill. In the earlier one, kill the idolaters. It doesn't say kill the Jews and Christians until they, pay the jizya. It says fight them until they pay the jizya.
But the interesting thing here is fight those who are going to believe in God or in the last day.
The judgment of God,
huh?
They don't believe in the judgment of God.
No, I understand, but still the Jewish way of looking at the last day is so entirely different than the Muslim or the Christian.
Is it?
I think.
Okay. A third is interesting. Jews say Uzair is called son, and the Christians say, the Mashiach is called son. That's what they say with their mouths. And so those who earlier were unbelievers said, God should fight them. How can they be so disbelieving?
Yeah. Could we not go there though yet? That's a really important verse. It's very interesting. But let's try to stay with this one for now. any other comments about this? Any other things that strike you?
I still come back. Is the Jewish view on the last day very different? I think it's different from the Christian or the Muslim, you know, for the last day and then you come into heaven and everything. Which, then I would figure this would be also very anti-Jewish.
You
believe in God, but you don't believe in the last day, so you only, for 50% you're okay, so for 50% I can kill you.
But the belief in the last day is also sort of not fixed. I mean, what we now think about but what was at that time.
But the Yamat Mashiach is still something different than the last of the doom, and you go to heaven and everything.
It's
the afterlife.
They don't have a fixed ideology on what you want.
The Yom Hadin, the final judgment.
I think it's. I think it's directed against the leaders, because who do not forbid what God and His messengers forbade, and that seems to be directed towards authority and not to the people in general.
Okay.
Or maybe that is the translation. I don't know.
I think that's probably. That's interesting. I'd want to think about it because I haven't thought about it that way. In the Arabic, it says harama, who forbids for himself.
Oh, okay.
Doing. It doesn't say literally forbids for himself, but I think that's what it means. I don't think it's directed to leadership, but I'd have to look at that. Maybe that's an interesting reading.
Well, these are texts, and we never looked at very short what Jews do with texts like this. What do Muslims do with these texts?
Oh, well, I'm still not done with the text.
Okay.
Do you have one more piece of the text?
Yeah.
It looks like you guys didn't resonate with one piece of this that I found interesting. I'm not sure if it's also an accurate reading, but it says, let's just read it this way. Fight those who don't believe in God or in the last day, who don't forbid what God and His messenger forbade, and who do not practice the religion of truth until they pay the jizya offhand, being humbled or humiliated. Does that sound like a good reading? What's wrong with that reading? It's a very long phrase.
It sounds like unless you pay the jizya, then you might not believe in God. Is that what you mean? As soon as they have paid these things, then they can have whatever thought in their minds. Is that what you mean?
Well, see, I read this as if this applies to the people of the book, why do you say all these things like fight all those people who don't believe in God of the last day, don't believe it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who are people of the book? Why don't you just say fight the people of the book until they pay the jizya?
Well, because it gets progressively more restrictive, more particular. I mean, fight those who do not believe in God for the last day, that's probably the broadest statement. And then it narrows down to who do not forbid the God's message of forbade, and then who do not practice the religion of truth, which is Islam. So then you're
maybe. Certainly from the first phrase to the second phrase there's a narrowing, but I'm not sure if the second and third phrase are any narrow.
Is it deliberate? Is it not just talking about these people in a different way sometimes, because it's boring to call them people all the time?
Maybe. My intuitive reading is that this verse started out without the name People of the Book in it. It just was a general statement. Mm-hmm. That you should fight against those people who don't believe in God at the last day, don't forbid what God and His message forgive, don't practice the proper religion until they pay jizya. And then they, and that may have been a lesser punishment or whatever of people who aren't really being Muslims. Maybe even polytheists. Maybe it's a different way to say polytheists. Mm-hmm. But that later on, added to that was people of the book. Because mm-hmm. only those people would be the people that are acceptable. See, previously it might have been that as long, you know, you can have different levels of monotheism and polytheism. Polytheism is out. But if you have monotheism, or maybe even something in between polytheism and monotheism, it might be okay as long as they have second class status. But then it was pushed out and it was associated with people of the book. I just, grammatically, there's a problem with adding with from among the people of the book, because it seems really awkward in the Arabic.
So you say, you fight the polytheists until they pay the jizya and they are humiliated.
That might have been, maybe that was it. And then that then got ratcheted up to nine that said kill them. They don't even have a, you can't even have an opportunity to live anymore. And that, so then this verse will apply to the people of the book where you fight.
Who have to pay it.
Yeah, who have to pay it, and they won't be killed.
So when they put those in, they should take the first part out.
Yeah. But I don't know. I really don't know if that's, maybe they couldn't take the first part out because it was already understood as scripture and you can't erase scripture. Now, you were going to say some things about this verse that I sort of cut you off earlier that you were thinking about? No? Okay. In any case, these two verses are called the sword verses. One sword verse for polytheists, one sword verse for
9:5 and 9:29.
And also the abrogating verses. So verse 9:29, which we just read, abrogates the verse that we're about to read. And, oh, I remember you said, how do people read these texts?
Yes.
Yeah, right. So let's think about that. But let's read the next verse first. So could I have a reader to read Quran 2:62? We've already read this, but let's read it again.
Those who believe who are Jews and Christians and Sabaeans, whoever believes in God and the last day and who work righteousness, they have their reward with their Lord, for they shall not fear nor do they grieve.
Okay.
And two is abrogated?
Okay, now, look, these are all divine verses. So it looks like Quran 9:29, which we just read, contradicts entirely Quran 2:62, right? One says they're exactly equal, Jews and Christians, Sabaeans and believers.
Yeah.
And the other one says, no, they have to be humbled or humiliated. They're second class and they have to pay a tax. So what's the story?
No, I don't see that. The number two is the those who believe. The other one also, they shall not fear. And the other one says, fight those who do not believe in God or in the last day. So it does not contradict.
Okay. From among the people of the book. So that means the people of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you could, I see what you're saying. You're saying that among, you don't fight the people of the book unless they're people of the book who don't believe in God in the last day and don't forbid what God has been forbidden. So therefore, okay.
I guess
you could say
that. But then they're not believers.
One could say that.
But they belong to that people, so well, they're privately. And
atheists,
Right. But they're Jewish, so they belong to the group.
That depends on your definitions.
They could still even be.
Look at all the room for commentary on this, by the way. So, all right. So, in the exegetical tradition, this was seen as a contradiction. and there can't be a contradiction, and so one has to be abrogated and the other one has to be abrogating. And it was determined that the chapter 9 verse abrogates the chapter 2 verse. Chapter 9 was possibly the last revelation of the Quran, where the verses in chapter 9, and so they would abrogate the things that come before. It's a pity. But chapter 2 was also a late verse, frankly. Chapter 2 is a late chapter. It's understood by the Muslim theorists to have been revealed in the later period in Medina, as was chapter 9. But chapter 9 is later than chapter 2. The militants conveniently say that the chapter 9 abrogates the others. And chapter 9.5, which is the most violent one, is said to abrogate, depends on who you talk to, up to like 120 verses. Meaning everything that's more, that's not militant, it abrogates. So.
Really?
Yeah. Now, that's not everybody. That's what is the imperialist, empire-supportive, we need to be strong and we need to control the world position. That's that position.
Yeah, but I mean...
not everybody today, and not... Right. So if you were to talk to Muslims who are engaged in dialogue with Jews and Christians and people who want to involve... I'm going to look in the United States. There are lots and lots of Muslims who are dealing with this and are trying to figure out how to respond to this
seven,
problem.
The other billion are living not in the United States.
Yeah, the other, that's right. And they're not reading this stuff anyway. They're just listening to the radio.
They don't understand it.
Hmm?
They don't understand what it said.
Yeah, maybe.
I hope so.
So all we're dealing, I'm not dealing with really interpretation here, I'm just dealing with the original sources and how they can be interpreted. Look, all of these things, when they're, you know how academics would like to coin some phrase that becomes like an idiom of speech? Well, here's mine, hasn't caught on yet. Where there's a political will, there's an exegetical way. Right? So. But...
theology is not an exact science.
Yes.
You can prove anything you want from physics.
So, we know that there are people who are doing, trying to make sense of these things in a way that... So I'd just like to end with Psalm 3 because it's so great. Someone want to read that one?
That's about the heads on the, throwing the heads on the children's heads on the stones?
Oh, no, that's Psalm 1.
Psalm David, when he's praying for his son, Absalom.
Abba Shalom.
Oh Lord, my foes are so many, many are those who attack me. Many say of me, there is no deliverance for him through God, but you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, you are a host, my head high. I cry aloud to the Lord, and he asks me from his holy mouth, and I lie down and sleep away again, for the Lord sustains me. I have no fear of the myriad forces arrayed against me on every side.
Yeah.
Rise, O Lord, deliver me, my God, for you slap all my enemies in the face. You break the teeth of the wicked. Deliver us, the Lord. Your blessing be upon your people. May he bless us with strength, and then we shall fight for the peace.
Remember, Adonai Yivarechet Amo V'Shalom, so that we can wreak havoc on everybody else.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Make us strong and we'll reach peace.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. All right, so some texts. These are some of the classic texts.
Yeah, have a short break then?
Sure.